Going online without ExpressVPN is like confessing your sins at church, but everyone can read your mind. You may not have anything to hide, but is it really everyone's business? This is why everyone needs a VPN, because all your traffic flows through their servers. Internet service providers, including mobile network providers, know every single website you visit. ExpressVPN reroutes 100% of your traffic through secure, encrypted servers, so your internet service provider can't see your browsing history. ExpressVPN will hide your IP address, making it extremely difficult for third parties to track your online activity. All you have to do is fire up the app and click one button to get protected. I use ExpressVPN personally to protect my online activity from hackers, spammers, and the deep state. Protect your online privacy today by visiting expressvpn.com/matter. That's expressvpn.com/matter. And you can get an extra 3 months free. expressvpn.com/matter. There's a new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions called Morning Kick. It combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. All you do is mix with water, stir, and enjoy. It tastes like strawberry lemonade, not like ground-up spinach. Morning Kick is part of my daily routine. It's replaced orange juice in my life as the first place I go when I wake up. And since I've been drinking it, I've had better digestion and more energy. For me, that's important now that I have a newborn who, let's just say, doesn't always sleep like a baby. My health is important to me, just like it's important to you. I want to be the best version of myself spiritually, mentally, and physically. If you feel sluggish, it's worth giving Morning Kick a try. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/Harris for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/HARRIS today. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary. All right, we're live on the Conversations That Matter podcast. We have a special guest with us today who hasn't been on the podcast before, Mr. Josh Turner, and he is the chief of constitutional policy in the Idaho's AG's office. He's been working on some pro-life legislation, defending it. And we're going to talk to him today about how to go about defending pro-life legislation, not just in Idaho, but in the current paradigm where states are, conservative states are taking it upon themselves to limit abortion. How can they do that, whether it's a Trump presidency or a Harris presidency? So with that, Josh, thank you so much for being willing to talk to me and joining the podcast.
Yeah, glad to be here, John.
So let's start with the beginning here. Idaho has a law that is being called by some, at least, an abortion ban. What does it do? Does it actually ban abortion, I guess, would be the first question. How does it limit abortion if it doesn't completely ban it? And then what are some of the things that pro-choice or pro-abortion advocates are saying to try to discredit it and bring legal challenges against it?
Yeah, so after the Dobbs decision, which was the Supreme Court's decision that overturned Roe v. Wade and effectively said states have the authority to regulate on the issue of abortion, there is no federal constitutional right to an abortion. So it put the issue back into state control. The state of Idaho had a law on the books called the trigger law that the legislator said, if Roe v. Wade ever gets overturned, this law will go into effect in 30 days. And that trigger law is called the Defense of Life Act. And it is pejoratively called not just the abortion ban, but the total abortion ban. And so, but it doesn't totally ban abortion. What it does is it prohibits abortion except in three circumstances. The first is rape, the second is incest, and the third is, it prohibits abortions in all circumstances except rape, incest, and then the third is...
life of the mother.
To prevent the death of the mother. Yeah, now that's a little bit different than most states, which have a health exception, and the health exception is broader. Idaho drew its exception for the life of the mother to really be the life of the mother. And it explicitly says that mental conditions or self-harm are not a basis to provide an abortion.
Yeah, so maybe let's zoom in a little bit on Idaho, because Idaho is unique. Every state is, and Idaho has a high Mormon population. It's known as a deep red state, although the Idahoans I talk to don't seem to believe that press about themselves. They think that it's more establishment Republican and moderate. But the conditions in Idaho, are they suitable for, I mean, does the population want a actual total abortion ban, or do you think this law reflects the will of the population there?
Yeah, I think I'm not from Idaho, so I'll tread lightly here, but from what I can tell, having been there and talking with the legislature, who presumably represents the will of the people, this is exactly what is what the people want. And, you know, personally, I think the exceptions for rape and incest are not ideal, and I don't think they're moral. You're effectively punishing the unborn child for actions that were and wrongs done by other parties. But the life of the mother in my mind, it's a moral exception, and there's a lot of nuance to why that's the case. But the simplest analogy I'll draw is self-defense. We all recognize that another person does not have the right to harm you, whether that person intends to harm you or does so even unintentionally. So, for example, if you are walking down the street and somebody pushes another person into you, and if you did not take action to defend yourself against that other person being pushed into you, you would be flung into the street in front of a bus. You don't have to sit there and let that, you know, unintending party get shoved into you and get thrown in front of a bus. You can put your hands up. And a mother is essentially doing that when her child is threatening her life. There's a moral way to go about terminating the pregnancy, and doctors ought to have that in mind when they are ethically treating a mother's condition that is life-threatening and not intend to kill the fetus. They should not take action that intends to kill the unborn child. Like a D&E is a horrible procedure, because what it is doing nothing more than intentionally ending the life of the unborn child in one of the most barbaric ways possible. But you can separate, and I think there's a term called medically indicated separation, where the mother and the child are separated, and medical attention is given to both at that point. And if the child is pre-viable, the chances of survival are unlikely. But if the child is around the 20 or 21 week range, medical attention should be given to both. And it's possible that both the mother and the child can survive in that circumstance. When you do a D&E, there's no chance of survival unless there's a miracle or a flaw in the D&E procedure itself. So back to your original question, I want to stray there a bit, John. I think this is what Idaho, the people of Idaho want. They've elected people who are largely, the legislature is largely Mormon controlled. And, I work for the attorney general, and the attorney general is a Mormon. And he's told me that it is part of the Mormon faith. It is a part of their dogma, their doctrine, that there be exceptions for rape and incest. So I don't see how a state that is dominated by a Mormon population like that, which has voting control, I don't know if they're the majority population, but they at least have plurality control, is ever going to pass a law that doesn't reflect the dogma of their faith.
Gotcha. So you would say, since you're defending this law, essentially, that this is a step in the right direction, at least as far as limiting abortion. Are there Planned Parenthood still in operation in the state of Idaho? Because I've heard they've all been run out of the state or at least they can't proceed with abortion procedures.
Yeah, I know that there are still Planned Parenthoods in the state because they have sued us. And okay. So I don't think they're providing any abortions. In fact, I know that they're not providing any abortions unless they're doing so illegally. But these operations maintain storefronts for other purposes. And so I think there is still one clinic in the Boise area. Now, you're right, I am defending the law. Whether I think like this is a step in the right direction versus a, you know, a true total abortion ban that only has an exception for the life of the mother, I'm not sure about that policy choice. That that would be my preference, that there wasn't an exception for rape and incest. I'll say that the exceptions are drawn pretty narrowly. You can't just claim I was raped, or you can't just claim that your pregnancy is the result of incest. And so I think that the legislation has done a good job with the flawed exceptions being the case. I think it's done a good job to limit them as much as possible.
So what are the arguments then? You said Planned Parenthood sued you, and I'm assuming maybe there's other pro-abortion groups that are trying to explore avenues to get this knocked out in court. What are their arguments that they're using?
Well, the Planned Parenthood litigation is a little bit different than the EMTALA litigation that went up to the Supreme Court. So I can talk about both real quick. The Planned Parenthood sued Attorney General Labrador for issuing a letter to a legislator named Brent Crane. He had been asked by this legislator whether a doctor could refer women to an out-of-state clinic for an abortion, and whether that would violate Idaho's Defense of Life Act. And he responded and said, no, a doctor cannot refer a woman to an out-of-state abortion clinic consistent with Idaho law. And they sued and said, oh, you're preventing doctors from telling their patients where they can go get lawful medical care. Because in Washington or Oregon, they're like sitting there on the border waiting and ready for women to come across and get abortions. And Planned Parenthood is like trying to funnel women over there. And there's even groups that are setting up like funds to transport women. I mean, it's really quite evil what's going on. There's we have another law called the abortion trafficking statute that makes it illegal to traffic a minor across the border for an abortion and without the parent's consent, you know, something very basic and common sense. And we got sued over that. And the groups are arguing that they somehow have a First Amendment right to take minor girls across the border without their parents' knowledge or consent for abortions. And like, we're living in loony times here. But anyways, the letter said, no, a doctor cannot refer women.
Can I just interject? So it's the argument then that because of the Dobbs decision, you can't claim that there's a fundamental or a constitutional right for an abortion, but there is a right to transport someone to another state who's a minor for an abortion. Am I understanding this correctly?
Yeah. I mean, their argument is we're engaged in First Amendment free speech activities. And when we find a woman, a minor girl who's pregnant, we have a right to go and associate with her. We have a right to go and tell her where she can get an abortion. And we have a right to go and take her there. That's all First Amendment activity, they say. Of course it's not, because if that's First Amendment activity, then a bank robber could say, it's also First Amendment activity for me to associate with other bank robbers and to go and find a bank and rob that bank and ask the teller with a gun pointed at his head to give me all the money. Like, there's a difference between conduct, illegal conduct, and speech. And you know, the First Amendment speech doctrine is very convoluted, but most people understand that, yes, you can advocate for abstract ideas, even if they're illegal. Like, you can say, I could tell you on here that communism's great and we should work to overthrow our government as an abstract idea. Like that's what the First Amendment protects. But if you start to get close to the line of telling somebody how to overthrow the government and making concrete plans, I don't know if these allegations were ever true, but the allegation was made that there were people in Michigan who were conspiring to kidnap Gretchen Whitmer, right?
And right.
Like that's if whatever the allegations, whether they were true or not, if they were true, the allegation was that they became so concrete that they were now illegal and not simply abstract ideas. So we're just seeing people who are bloodthirsty to commit abortions. They have gone crazy since the Supreme Court overturned Roe, and now any reasonable law is getting overturned. And I think this is an important point. You ask, why would a state need a law like the abortion trafficking statute? We're not out there, the people of Idaho are not out there like trying to make up new laws for the sake of getting sued. There was a real concern based on groups advertising publicly in companies. Even companies were like telling their employees, we'll pay for you to go get an abortion in another state, that young women would be afraid to tell their parents that they got pregnant, and they would fall into the hands of these groups that want only to abort their baby. They don't want to direct them to a crisis pregnancy center or any other location. All they want to do is tell them how they can abort their baby. And these women are minors. And, you know, minors don't have fully developed decision making. And they certainly don't know, all that in abortion entails. And abortions are not safe. They're not, nobody would bat an eyelash if a state said, you cannot traffic minors across state borders to go get pot or to go get a tattoo or any even benign things without their parents' consent. Like you've got to tell the minor's parent what you're going to do with their child. But when it comes to abortions, like, okay, I guess we can go take minor children without their parents' consent to get these surgical operations.
So evil. So evil. So let me ask you this. On these cases, first I'll say this, anyone who's just now coming in, because I noticed a number of people are joining the live stream. If you have a question for Josh Turner, who's the guest today on the podcast, he is the one responsible for essentially defending these policies, the abortion trafficking statute and the right to life law. Let me know. Ask your question in the chat. I know there's a lot going on nationally, and because abortion is now more of a state-by-state issue, folks like Josh Turner are going to be important moving forward and the arguments that he's making. But Josh, let me ask you this. So the challenges that you're receiving that are in the court system right now, what do you predict is going to happen? Are you going to be arguing, what's going to happen at the Supreme Court level if you get to that point, which it sounds like you very well might?
So I'll take the three cases we have. With EMTALA, we went up to the Supreme Court. We got a pretty good result. We got the federal government, the Solicitor General Prelogger, to make a number of big concessions. And based on those concessions, the Supreme Court said, Idaho's Defense of Life Act is almost entirely intact and enforceable. Go back to the Ninth Circuit and litigate this in the normal course. And if we have to come back after that, if there's still a dispute, we will. So EMTALA is in a pretty good place. We got a big victory there. And the Solicitor General and federal government is, basically litigating with their tail between their legs right now. The abortion trafficking statute that I mentioned to you, I argued that at the Ninth Circuit, and we had a liberal panel. But the liberal panel seemed to recognize the issues with the First Amendment argument and claim being advanced by these crazy groups, and we're waiting on that decision. I expect, based on how argument went, that we will win, and the First Amendment claim will be rejected and that law will be fully enforceable. And then the Planned Parenthood lawsuit, that just is, I don't know what's going to happen with that lawsuit. It's kind of a weird lawsuit in the first place. The law, most people do not understand the law to prohibit doctors from referring patients across borders. I think the legislature would need to take action, separate action, to clarify the law. and they just haven't done so yet. But in the next legislative session, the legislature may say, by prohibiting abortions, we also are prohibiting you from being an accomplice to an abortion. And being an accomplice to an abortion can include referring a person across state borders.
So that's really the one that's probably the big decision that remains to be seen, the Planned Parenthood case. What are the implications of this then for other states as far, like, I don't know exactly what states are looking at similar legislation right now, but it sounds to me like this is the only way to proceed if you want to limit abortion, is working through the state on the state level.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are at least 22 other states that have pretty good abortion bans. Idaho and Missouri and maybe Texas have like some of the strictest in terms of limiting it to life of the mother. Texas Texas says it's a health exception, but they define health to be essentially a condition that is life threatening. Other states have broader exceptions, and nevertheless, they're being challenged. So this, if the notion by these groups, and they say this in Idaho, but they're not saying it in other states, they say, oh, we need a health exception. Like the largest health system in Idaho, St. Luke's, has said, we're not out campaigning against abortion bans. We just think that our doctors don't know how to determine when the life of the mother is on the line. So please give us a health exception. It's a total pretext for getting rid of abortions, because all of these same people are out litigating other states and suing those states for their health exceptions. So what does it mean for these other states? Well, what the Impala litigation means for other states is the federal government's theory is bunk, and the litigation they have going in Texas is they're gonna lose there. They've sued or threatened to sue hospitals in Kansas for abiding by Kansas's law. And so that litigation should probably go away soon. And other states should feel empowered to tighten their abortion restrictions as much as they can. Now, I don't think that the pro-life movement should be comfortable with leaving this issue in state hands, because there's always going to be New York, there's always going to be California. And what we're seeing in Idaho is very difficult to enforce our law effectively when we've got bordering states that are welcoming women. And on top of that, now you have these pharmaceutical companies like Danco who are shipping abortifacients into our state. Those abortifacients are illegal, and yet we cannot effectively prevent them being shipped into our state through the mails and providing abortions for women illegally, but effectively untraceably. And so I think the pro-life movement needs to take very seriously a federal national push under the 14th Amendment that would protect unborn life in the same way that nationally, federally, we needed an amendment to protect protect African Americans.
So I want to get into the 14th Amendment argument a little more, but I'm assuming the reason that you cannot limit on the state level the abortifacients coming in is because of interstate commerce. This is a federal issue. Is there, I guess this might lead into the next thing I wanted to talk about, but the difference between a potential Trump administration or a Harris administration on this issue. I'm not sure if there are things that in the executive office that can be done, or would this need a legislative solution to limit something like abortifacients coming into the state? Because there's other things that we limit, right? Like, you're not supposed to bring certain illegal drugs and things like that into the country. So so what would be the route there, and what difference do you see between those two administrations on that question and abortion more broadly?
Well, the difference is stark. And I say that being disappointed with the RNC softening its platform on pro-life issues, that, you know, obviously was a political calculus, and it may also accurately reflect the views of the people in power at the RNC. I don't know. But still, nevertheless, there's still a world of difference between the Biden-Harris administration and their views on abortion, and even the most moderate Republican. And a Trump-Vance administration is by no means moderate. Like, I take Vance at his word that he's a serious Catholic. And, you know, Catholics are incredibly consistent when it comes to pro-life issues. So I imagine that the platform probably is more a political, is political cover rather than reality. But I don't know that for sure. Anyways, on day one, there's going to be immediate differences. So let's take mifepristone, for example, which is the abortifacient. There's a law on the books that is being ignored by the current Biden administration and the DOJ, known as the Comstock Act. The Comstock Act, very clearly, everybody understands, prohibits the shipping of abortifacients in interstate mails. That's being ignored. Under a Trump administration, that won't be ignored. That will be enforced. And so immediately, Idaho's laws will become much more enforceable against abortifacients, and so will other states.
So you're saying we actually have the law in place. It's just not being followed.
Yes. The reason it's not being followed, there's a couple. I mean, just outright unlawfulness. But I think this law dates back to the late 1800s. And old laws tend to get ignored, or they tend to fall by the wayside. And so the FDA, Food and Drug Administration, has to approve any pharmaceutical that's on the market. And mifepristone is a pharmaceutical on the market that's been approved by the FDA. Now, it came with strings attached, that approval did. And under the Biden administration and the Obama administration, the safety net, like the obstacles to getting a prescription for mifepristone, have essentially been reduced to nothing. When it first came on the market, the FDA said, this drug is so dangerous that you have to have 3 in-person doctor visits. It has to be limited to the first 7 weeks of a pregnancy. And it has to be prescribed by a physician, not a nurse, not anybody, an actual physician, with pretty robust informed consent procedures. Most of that has gone away. And now a woman through a telehealth appointment can get mifepristone shipped to her at her house under the Biden administration. The Trump administration's FDA is going to immediately undo that and reimpose those tougher restrictions. So that will make the drug harder to get. And then with the Comstock Act being enforced and abided by, that will make the drug being shipped to states where it is illegal, you know, it'll make those laws enforceable. And then when you get to the 14th Amendment, and I know, you know, I see in the chat, somebody thinks it's not a great idea. Let me just kind of note, whether it's a good idea or not, the amendment it embodies a wonderful principle, the equal protection of all persons. And in the pro-life movement, our fight depends on the fetus being a real person. And we can never concede that ground, because if you concede the ground that the unborn child is a person as much as the born child, then any number of rationalizations enter the picture. And now you're talking about fetal pain, fetal heartbeats. You draw lines along utility rather than principle. And that's where the problem comes in. So I think the 14th Amendment is a good tool, because it embodies a principle that we as Christians understand is just, treating the unborn child as a person who has rights given to them by their creator, just like any other person, and they have to be given equal protection. And the whole point of the federal government, the 14th Amendment and the federal government post-Civil War, was to prevent states from treating persons unequally. And so California, you can't treat your unborn children differently than Idaho treats its unborn children. And so I think the 14th Amendment is a viable option. It's going to take a change in the hearts of our culture to recognize the implications of personhood for children. And I'll note, when I was arguing EMTALA, the left was going crazy when they got any sniff that we were advancing fetal personhood. They call it fetal personhood. They think that's one of the most dangerous things out there. Hmm. And so if that makes the left afraid, I'm all for it.
Well, that's a certainly baseline at the end there. If the left is afraid of it, I'm for it. People are normally a little more active in the chat today, and I'm wondering if people are just really enjoying our back and forth. But if you do have questions and you're listening right now, we have Josh Turner with us, who has been arguing even before the Supreme Court, defending defense of life law in Idaho. And he's also defending the abortion. Was it the trafficking statute? I think you called it. And so these are really important laws. This is happening on the state level, but there's a lot of things in play right now, or open questions, I should say, given the political landscape and what might happen in the next election. Let's talk about the 14th Amendment argument real quick, and then maybe get back to the election stuff, because I want to know a little bit more about what's going to happen if the Democrats get in there. Like, what's the worst case scenario here? But with that argument, this is the concern I think some have about the 14th Amendment. I know I share this to some extent. It seems to me that, as you correctly observed, the 14th Amendment was for a context in which it applied to former slaves, right, who were newly freed, and the political rights that they would have entering into political society for the first time, and those kinds of things. And I guess those who are really for original intent are probably concerned that the left has used this. In fact, right, Roe v. Wade used the 14th Amendment, right, to find a right to privacy. And it seems like a lot of landmark decisions that push the needle left use the 14th Amendment. And so I guess the question in my mind, and I'd love for you to just respond to this, is do we then engage in the same kind of thing the left is doing, treating the 14th Amendment in a way that would have probably surprised those who crafted it, because they weren't thinking about that. They weren't trying to define what life is. It was just assumed that everyone knew what a life was, and states that are defining this differently wasn't on their minds. And if that's the argument, if it's, hey, we just use this just like the left does, I get it. But, you know, is there an actual original intent styled argument to make from the 14th Amendment, or is this innovative? What do you think?
Well, I mean, there have been scholarly articles written on how an originalist could interpret the 14th Amendment to understand that person, as used in the 14th Amendment, did originally encompass unborn children. Now, here's what I would say. I am not an originalist. Maybe that will shock you, but I'm not an originalist. Why am I not an originalist? Because the Constitution is not a statute. It is not a code. It is a constitution. And constitutions are very different than statutes. I read statutes in an originalist way, but constitutions are meant to be an enduring document that memorializes core principles of a society. Those principles are not susceptible to an originalist methodology of interpretation. So, for example, the Ninth Amendment. How would an originalist interpret the Ninth Amendment? The Ninth Amendment it's not possible to interpret under an originalist methodology. Or pick any other part of the Constitution. When Article 3 vests the Supreme Court with, quote, judicial power is never defined in Article 3 or Article 1's vesting the Congress with legislative power. Legislative power is not defined. These are concepts that you have to understand in reference to divine principles, in reference to natural law. And so we understand legislative power in reference to how God acts as a legislator. We understand judicial power in relation to how God is judge. And the distinction of when a government official is acting in a judicial role versus an executive role versus a legislative role, these are not questions that can be answered by originalism. And the originalists don't even try to say that they are. It's not, to me, a credible method of interpreting the Constitution, or I should say every question of the Constitution. So we get to the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment guarantees equal protection for all persons and due process. Well, these are terms that are not defined by the Constitution itself. And then you have to ask, okay, so what principle are we going to look to? Do we have a dictionary in the addendum to the Constitution? No, we don't. So what's going to be our guiding light? And to me, the answer is simple. It's natural law, because and my reason is, where does any government authority come from in the first place? Well, we understand in the United States that God has delegated power to the people, and the people took that power and delegated it to a national government, and they delegated other power that they have to state governments. And so we've got this federalism divide, but the power originally does not come from the people. The power originally comes from God, and we cannot delegate to the federal government power that we never had in the first place. And so I would argue no constitution, and certainly not the U.S. Constitution, could ever delegate to state governments the power to kill unborn children, because the people never had that power to do it themselves. And so any just constitution has to recognize the authority of the state and federal governments to intervene and protect unborn children. It's as simple as that for me.
Gotcha. Well, and the Constitution does invoke the British common law, I think, by name, right? I forget where that is, but there's...
Well, I mean, it's built on the tradition of Magna Carta. And like Magna Carta is invoking the same principles. And the common law tradition that we inherited and brought over, I mean, Blackstone's commentaries begin with divine law. He says all law must be consistent with divine law. And and by divine law, he's not saying, natural law in the sense I look out in nature and perceive things. He's talking about scripture. And so let me address maybe the heart of your concern and others' concern that if we throw out originalism, then we're going to allow the left to come up with these crazy rights like the right to privacy, which includes the right to abortion. And my answer to that is, whether it's originalism or whatever boundaries you try to put on these judges, they're not going to abide by them. And just because somebody abuses the laws of physics or laws of mathematics or whatever, we don't ignore the fact that there are laws of physics and there are laws of mathematics. Like 2 + 2 continues to be 4, even if a leftist judge tries to tell me that 2 + 2 = 5. And when a leftist judge says that there is a fundamental right to castrate and sterilize children with pharmaceuticals, and the state can't do anything to intervene, I say no. And the problem is not that they are not being originalists. The problem is that they're wicked judges. And you don't change wicked judges by imposing an external rule called originalism on them, because if they're not going to abide by common logic and sense, they're certainly not going to abide by originalism. And they haven't. I mean, originalism is a construct that came about in the 80s by Robert Bork. And it was a reaction against the Warren Court. It was a reaction against activist judges. And the answer to activist judges is not to be overly constrained judges. The answer to activist judges is to have judges who are moral.
Yeah. What? So I'm just to clarify for people, because I think it's fascinating. I'm learning here. When you talk about originalism, it sounds like you're talking about something that you just said, very constrained and narrow. What would be the philosophy that you're advocating for then? Is there a name for it? Originalism, or
it's a natural law philosophy. And I would say it is the jurisprudence of our great Chief Justice, John Marshall. And you interpret the Constitution according to both its letter and spirit. And originalism stops at the letter part. It says you interpret the Constitution only according to its letter. And you don't ask anything about its spirit or purpose or object. An object analysis is crucial, because if I say to you, you have a Second Amendment right to bear arms, and you stop there, and now you have a historical debate about what the term arms means, and you never get into the spirit or purpose of the Second Amendment, which is that the people have a right to serve as a check, a military check against their government, against tyrannical government. And so we see courts that are using an originalist methodology say, well, you can have a right to bear this type of gun, but not these other military type of guns. Like, you can't have an M16, but you can have a 9mm. And an AR-15, we're not really sure about that. We'll sort it out through some sort of like ad hoc historical right. analysis. And I think, no, that's bunk. You're not doing law. That's not law at all. I can have any arm that serves the purpose of checking a tyrannical government. And I think an M16 probably does a pretty good job of that.
Yeah, sure. So I don't think, there's like a fundamental disagreement. I thought of originalism as including the broader context and the society, the intentions behind it, what it meant to that original audience, and then those principles being applied in our modern context. So I wasn't thinking of it in terms.
You're right that originalism has changed, and there are different types of originalists today. So the first originalism in its earliest form by Ed Meese and Robert Bork was pretty much just this very narrow textualism. But then, they realized, our theory has some holes. And so then they came up with original public meaning. But then original public meaning has some holes. And so now there's others who have come up with like original public intent. And there's all of these competing theories that have nuances in what they mean. But what they all exclude, what originalism necessarily excludes, is a reference to natural law and consideration of the object of the clause. It is a historical methodology. You are telling judges you must act as historians, and judges aren't historians, and they really don't do history very well.
Well, yeah, that's been proven time and time again. Man, I have so many more questions I'd love to ask, but I do want to, since I told you we were going to go for 45 minutes and we've gone almost 40, I do want to ask you about the Democrats and what do you perceive happening if Harris, who looks like she might be the nominee, if she gets in there, how's that going to make your job harder and the jobs of other people in your positions in conservative states?
If there's a Harris administration, it means that we get to sue the federal government a whole lot more than under a Trump administration. We've been very
job security.
Busy. Yeah, we've been very busy suing just outside of the life issue. We have been waging war on the administrative state in a number of areas. In the West, in Idaho, water is precious. Land resources are precious, and the environmentalists are really having a heyday with the EPA and getting them to promote an agenda that just lacks any type of common sense. And so we'll see more of that. It'll get worse. Now we have had success in the courts, and I think we would continue to have success, but litigation can't keep pace with the administrative state under a Harris administration. So it will just be 4 more years of nonstop litigation, trying to get as many injunctions in place on the administrative state as possible.
So if anyone wants to ask a question, please get it in now. I'm going to start the process of getting to some of your comments and questions. And then I want to give you the last word, Josh, because I know as this goes out there, there'll be thousands of Christians watching this or listening, and even after it's recorded. And I want to know what you think they ought to know moving into this election season, and what are some takeaways even on the debate that you're involved in on the life issue. So let's go to this question actually first. What exactly is the Republican platform statement on abortion? My understanding is that they support the SCOTUS decision, that it is a state issue based on federalism, which is really what we've been talking about. So if you want to go ahead and answer that, it sounds straightforward to me, but enlighten us.
Yeah, my understanding is that, yes, that's true, that the new RNC platform recognizes that this is the Dobbs decision returned the issue of abortion to the states. But they've also gone and softened their views on abortive patients when they mifepristone is the generic name of the drug, and then also what exceptions should be permitted. I have not dove in deeply on it. I was at a conference last week when that was changed, and I heard that it was softened in a number of ways, and I think the softening, from what I understand, So I'm talking a little bit ignorantly, but I think the softening, from what I understand, happened at sort of the principal level. Like, we as a Republican Party are not taking a full-throated life stand from conception to birth. And it's been watered down a little bit, which has disappointed a lot of people. So that's a little bit separate from that principal issue, is a little bit separate from the legal question of what Dobbs did and whether states have the right to legislate on the issue.
I would add also, I mean, there are people that because of this are saying we're not going to support the Republican Party anymore. They're pro-choice and this kind of thing. And I don't hear you saying that they're, you're saying it sounds like that it's a much better option to vote for the Republicans despite this weakening platform, given, I guess, what the Democrats would do if they got in office.
Yeah. I don't put, I will, my conscience will not be hurt voting for Republicans by and large. I mean, I'm sure there are some Republicans I wouldn't be able to vote for, but in terms of a Harris administration versus a Trump administration, to me, it's easy. And I'll repeat what I said earlier. I don't think that the platform, whatever it was watered down to be, is actually going to be reflective of the Trump administration. He ruled, he's a tyrant ruling in DC. No, he governed far more conservatively on abortion than even Reagan did. And to me, that gives me great comfort and confidence that this was probably just political cover. And like, Trump at the end of the day is a utilitarian. He's going to take whatever political cover and not feel bound one bit by it. His yes is not his yes. We all know that. And in this case, I very much hope that his yes is not his yes.
Yeah. Big Yehuda asked, I guess, is going back to what we were talking about before about the 14th Amendment. Josh, can you get a law enforcing death penalty with immediate enforcement and no appeal? Will you support telling SCOTUS to pound sand if they overturned? So actually, no, this isn't 14th Amendment, perhaps, but on the state level. So sounds like you don't have a problem telling SCOTUS to pound sand.
Well, I think Big Yehuda's point is rhetorical, and he is arguing against the strategy of using the 14th Amendment by drawing an analogy with the death penalty. And I would say, well, look, the death penalty. The death penalty should be, I mean, it is a moral punishment that some states still have, including Idaho, and it ought to be carried out swiftly. Now, with no appeal, no, because there's something known as the due process clause, and due process mm-hmm. ensures that there is a right of appeal and that we're not putting to death people who do not deserve to be put to death. To me, that doesn't change the 14th Amendment argument. The 14th Amendment allows for intervention and protection of unborn children because they are persons. And the 8th Amendment prohibits cruel and unusual punishment, even for criminals. And the Due Process Clause requires all persons, including criminals, to receive adequate due process of law. So all of these protections are, I think, are consistent with each other. They work hand in hand. And I don't know that I see them as somehow inconsistent or making a 14th Amendment argument for fetal personhood a bad idea. Is it like politically tenable now? No. That's not going to change with the next Congress. What needs to change is people need to start electing moral legislators, but those moral legislators have to reflect the collective conscience of the people. And right now, the collective conscience of our people is not to consistently recognize fetal personhood.
Yeah. Can you give me 5 more minutes? Is that okay? I hate to ask. You've been so generous.
I don't have anywhere to be. Don't worry about it.
You know, okay. All right. I'm going to take it then. Because I know this wasn't supposed to be about the 14th Amendment, but this is intriguing me quite a bit. The thing that just came to my mind was just birthright citizenship in the 14th Amendment. Cause it seems like when you read the 14th Amendment, isn't it talking about who is qualified or what rights extend to those who are in a political society? And it's defining that by saying like those who are born here, but it seems like they have to be born, right, to be citizens. So I'm just wondering like what the challenge would be if you tried to use this in a legal setting? And then why wouldn't this also apply to, I guess, illegal migrants who come over and have kids? I don't know where you stand on birthright citizenship.
I have not given that a whole lot of thought. I mean, I was around for the arguments during the Obama campaign and administration and sort of like heard them at a high level, but never paid too much attention to them. But the fact is that the 14th Amendment right now is used in a substantive way. It's called substantive due process, and the 14th Amendment is being used to provide protection of rights that are nowhere written in the Constitution. So, for example, where does the Constitution tell parents that they have a right to homeschool their children? It doesn't.
Yeah.
Where does the Constitution tell
10th Amendment, I would think, but right?
It doesn't explicitly. Where does the Constitution tell parents they have the right to teach their children German if they want to? Or tell where does the 14th Amendment give people the right to deny a medical intervention like a vaccine? Like, all of this is the check on government is not. The text of the Constitution is never on its own in an originalist methodology going to provide the types of rights and protections we all understand we have as creatures of God. You have to interpret the Constitution in reference to natural law. If you don't, you're going to end up in a distorted society where might makes right. That's all.
Well, it sounds like you're, and I'm sorry to cut you off, but it sounds like it's not just natural law. It sounds like you're also invoking cultural traditions and so forth, right? Because, you know, what constitutes being a citizen in a country is, I wouldn't think that would be a natural law thing so much as, I mean, I guess it is in the sense of recognizing the way God has set up nature and proximity to one another. But we have an arrangement in our country that's very specific compared to other countries. It's much easier to become an American than it is, you know, to become a Chinese person, or, you know what I mean?
And there are areas where, you know, Blackstone talks about, you know, he's analyzing what is a just punishment for a certain type of crime? And does it need to be the same in every society? Like, should jaywalking be punished in the UK the same as it is in the US? And, you know, he talks about the proximity of the person to their society, all of the background you're talking about. Like, it is relevant, and it does matter that there are historical traditions, and that does come into account in how our laws are written, how they're interpreted, how they're enforced. The whole like issue with immigration is something I'm not an expert in at all. And so I won't pretend to opine there, but I recognize you're right. Like, there is a historical background, and the current jurisprudence around substantive due process does ask, one of the questions that asks is if the right is so firmly rooted in the country's history and tradition. I think that's the test.
Right. So,
like, that is part of the legal analysis of substantive due process. You can't just come up with a new right. But I'll say that test is not going to answer the question in the right way of whether the Jim Crow South was moral, because it was firmly rooted in the history and tradition of the country to have separate but equal facilities, not just in the private sector, which is a harder question, but in the public sector. In the public sector, the governments, utility operators, transit operators were able to treat Black persons as inferior members of society. And if you were to ask, what has our culture historically done? You're not going to get the right answer.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was, depending on what time period you're looking at, I guess, all over the country, right? There was always a separation made between those in a political society and then those who aren't, whether it's Native Americans or slaves who came here, or I guess at one time, right, even certain classes of people like women. Or so, yeah, I mean, tradition is, there's a change that's been happening as we become more egalitarian. But it seems like our laws start to reflect that more. And obviously the court decisions seem to reflect that more. And when they've gone so far that they've started, we use the Roe v. Wade example, I forget the case, but the case, I think it was in the 40s where, or not the 40s, sorry, the the late, I think it was late 50s, where the First Amendment was applied to the states, where now you couldn't have Christian schools that distinctly honored Christianity, because that's a violation of the Establishment Clause and that kind of thing. Like, it seems like there's just such a reaction to that, because it's like we're moving so fast away from the traditions in our society that that's why people are like, man, I don't know, like the 14th Amendment, if we use that, you know, is something bad going to happen? So I'm rambling a little, sorry, but I'm just trying really to get the sense of
it. It brings up, let me just make one point in response to that, because I think there are at least two camps here on the conservative side. They ask the question, what would our founding fathers have thought? And they try to answer that question. And that the answer to that question is, in their minds, the right answer, the end of the analysis. And that's not how I think about things. I try to just ask, what is the right question? And yes, we have a constitution. Yes, we have laws that we have to work within. But the founders didn't get everything right as a matter of divine law in terms of practice. I think they set up principles that at a broad level are 100% moral, and we should be striving to attain those principles. They're announced in the Declaration, they're codified in the Constitution, and they provide us with a framework to answer all of the questions right. But we don't answer those questions right by asking what the historical practice was. We answer them right by asking what the historical principle is. And the principle is a little bit more flexible than what Ben Franklin thought or what Thomas Jefferson thought, because both were slave owners. And I don't know that owning slaves is consistent with the Declaration of Independence in any way.
Gotcha. Okay, so you gave me the 5 minutes, which I'm incredibly grateful for. I want to ask a final question here just for you. Open floor. We're really appreciating, you know, what you're doing in Idaho. And what do you want Christians who listen to this? Because there's a lot of Christians in this audience who will listen to it later on iTunes in audio form and watch the video. What do you want them to take from this and do for the anti-abortion cause? What would make your job perhaps even easier on the state level? And where can they go if they need to support your cause? I don't know if you have an organization or anything like that you want to plug, but you know, anything you want to talk about.
Yeah, no organization. My rallying cry would be that Christians start to winsomely and consistently defend the life of the unborn as persons. I think we've been shy about doing that. We've been hesitant to go out and say, in cases of rape and incest, there should not be an abortion permitted. Like, we make all of these practical concessions, including, and this is, I know this is hard, but I think in order to be consistent and in order to really fully defend the life of the unborn, we have to recognize that when a mother chooses to kill her unborn child, she is culpable, and the law needs to reflect her culpable act. And until the law reflects the full reality of that heinous act, we're never going to see those children as children. And so Christians out there need to start internally coming to terms with the fact that these are unborn children in the same way as a 6-month-old child that you're holding crying in your arms. And until we do that, our legislatures, no matter how moral they are ever going to be moved to legislate in a way that reflects their personhood.
Yeah. Well, Josh, I so appreciate your time. I know that you're doing this because you want people to be educated on this and mobilize. So thank you once again. And if people want to reach out and contact you, I don't know if you have an avenue to do that. If other people have questions, if you don't, or if you want, what we could do too is if people have questions, I can also, people can contact me and I can shoot them your way as well.
Be a good arrangement. You can be the filter.
I'll be the filter. I'm sure you have so much time to just sit there and answer questions, right? Once again, thank you. God bless. And I just pray that the election goes well and your job becomes a little easier moving forward. So have a good one. Bye now.
Thank you for having me.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on all your back-to-school needs, all in the Kroger app. Get three-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean ground beef for $3.99 a pound with your card. Then get Oreo cookies, Chips Ahoy, or Kool-Aid jammers for $1.99 each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.